Hello, hello, you're listening to the Goggler Podcast. Ian Baher and Uma with you. This week, we're going to be talking about Ghostbusters Afterlife. We're going to be talking about the brand new Jane Campion movie, The Power of the Dog. And we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of news as well. To kick things off today, we have to apologize for being 1 minute late. Why were we 1 minute late, Ian McNally?
Well, I said it. I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm in a new locale.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. I just noticed.
New backdrop.
I was too busy looking at my own face on Zoom.
I could see everybody. You could just see yourself. You just like look. That's why he keeps making eyes at the camera every week, Bahir. I kept wondering those kissy lips for those of you listening at home. He keeps doing that. It's weird.
Just
it's
for me.
Yeah. He's always mugging at the camera.
Yeah, I was playing Halo. One more minute in.
That's the long and short of it, really.
I could get one more in, but the reason why I'm in this room is because I had clumsy air conditioning guys break the air conditioning in the other room.
Oh. Yeah, and if we're doing a 90-minute podcast, you don't want to be dripping with sweat.
Yeah. And now it doesn't turn on, so they're waiting to get back to me. So that's annoying, especially when they're the ones they're the good ones you found after searching for years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Nah. Hmm. Oh, well, here we are on yet another episode of the Goggler Podcast.
Sorry, we won the game as well. And I was like, I killed 11 people and died 9 times. So it's a good kill death ratio. So.
That's good. Good ratio. Yeah, yeah.
That's good. Good. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Have a medal.
Oh, they got loads of those already. It's fine.
We're going to kick things off with some news, some local news, actually. Our good friends over at Kuman Pictures, that's Amir Muhammad's production company, have put a call out for a horror screenplay, and they're asking for you to send your best entry. You've got until 30th of May 2022, which is a long time to write the best possible horror flick you can come up with, which will be directed by Emir Eswan, who did Ro. So
yes,
yeah, it's got some good pedigree behind this.
Yeah, now hot tip, set it in a shack in the woods a la Ro as well if you want to get it made, probably.
Correct.
No,
correct.
But there's if you head over to the Kuman Pictures social medias, because they've got there's a very clear sort of description of what they're looking for. I think they're looking for, I think they specifically state that maybe one location or two locations. They don't have any issues with language, so that's good. They've even attached a proposed budget for it. So you know, give you an idea of what to write, which is great. I think it's a great way to go with it.
Did anyone check what the winning was from the last time they did this? They did it pre-pandemic.
I believe they shot that movie last year, I think. There was a Kuman production that was shot in between MCOs. And I think that was one of the winning entries, but I could be mistaken. Amir used to do this a lot, even with his Fixie books. He used to call, he used to do competitions. And there was one thing that he did that actually no other publisher does. And I think very few production houses do, is that there's a proper cash payment, right?
No. Hang on. Let me correct you. No production house in Malaysia.
Nobody does.
Yeah. Let's be straight. Yeah.
If you win, you get 20,000 ringgit, and you get 1% royalties off of any profit that the movie makes as well, which is unheard of in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. There was some news story about one of the ministers saying, "Oh, we'll see about setting up some redress board," because some creators hadn't got paid royalties because things hadn't been monetized, but the rights had been sold. And I was like, this follow-up question, rights sold equals monetized. You've sold the rights.
It is monetized. That, you don't get, which is definition of monetization. Yes.
Yeah. So I don't know if you saw that story. I didn't get the full
details. I missed that one. Yeah.
But it's a reality, right? I mean, the filmmaker, Burdett Chawley, who's a very good friend of mine, his movies, you know, are available to watch on Netflix. And every time they added one of his movies on Netflix, it was always trending in the top 10. Mm. But of course, he saw no money after whatever he was paid initially as a director of those films. And he's now based in the UK, and he's retrained as a professional chef. He went to cooking school. And in my last conversation with him, and I think he's even posted about this online, he's just said, you know what, there's no future for me as a filmmaker in Malaysia, and I get so much joy out of cooking for people. So he's just done a complete career change. And, you know, he was one of our better filmmakers But yeah. he too is completely jaded and disappointed in the system.
Plus, he can get paid after a meal. It's a lot less investment than getting paid after 6 months of your life or right. 5 years of your life.
Eventually, yeah, right. yeah. I mean, I mean, it's hard for me to. No, hang on, that's not right. I get where the creatives are coming from, but for right. me, it's also just this. It requires an overhaul of the system because this is what Hollywood used to be, right? It's that you buy the content, the right belongs to the content owner, and that's that. There's no such thing as
you buy the content, you buy the actors, you buy like old Hollywood, you buy everybody.
You buy everything and it's done, right?
But even under that system, they were getting paid to hang around and do nothing, you know?
Yeah,
they
sure.
Like they have the new project starring Cary Grant. It wasn't even Cary Grant, it's even before that.
They have that, the stable system, yeah. right?
Although, I don't know, is it called the stable system? Because they actually kept them in stables? I don't know.
Yes, I won't be surprised. They probably did keep them in stables, yeah. And I just think that on one hand, I get the creatives' complaints, but on the other hand, I'm also like, but that's the contract that was agreed upon. So it requires like an overhaul completely. It has to, you know, it requires Angkasa Puri and Media Prima and Astro to go, I want your content and I'm willing to share the profits with you. I think that's where the conversation needs to go. And that's just it, really.
I think the other thing, unionization is basically the only way.
Oh, no, absolutely. Seen, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ian, there are unions at the moment. They're just true. Pretty fucking useless.
Well, that's the point. Yeah. Like, they're not proper unions. As much as, like, you know, you give up every so many jokes about the Teamsters on so many things I hear about. But, like, the Animation Writers Guild is probably getting ready to go on strike, right? They're asking for actually living wages. The assistants have gone on strike in the US. It's like, these are, if you're in a group like that you are legion and you're getting abused, the only way to do it is for everybody to down tools. And we'll see how the TV channels will do when there's no content for a year.
And it took someone like Amir, like a completely private individual who has modeled Kuman after the kind of Blumhouse model with regards mm-hmm. to low budget filmmaking, et cetera, et cetera. But also in paying people, in giving them royalties as a kind of incentive to get talent to want to work with you, right? It's not yes. just... Mm. out of desperation. We hear so many stories of creatives in Malaysia going, oh, why did you do that? Ah, well, you know, I needed to feed myself for this
I got to eat. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully this moves the needle in some way. I don't know.
Hopefully you get a Paranormal Activity out of it or another row or something.
No, but I think that's the key, right? As long as Kuman keeps making stuff that people are talking about, that actually makes waves internationally, like Ro did, then I think everyone else is going to start to take notice.
And it's developing the talent as well. Like, you don't get to, if you go leave, be a chef, you don't, that talent is gone now. So someone else comes up, they do one movie, they get disillusioned, they leave. So if you get a small stable of people who are good ideas, they won't have the skills, and then they build it up, and then you have a industry on your hands.
No, but I think the other thing to remember is that Kuman is approaching it like a true business, right? They have... I think they've got two other projects in development at the moment. So potentially this screenwriting competition could be their third or their fourth. So they're constantly churning. They're working. Right? Yeah. They've got multiple projects in multiple stages of production or pre-production or creative. And I think that's kind of how you approach it, right? It's that studio Hollywood thing of make 10 movies, you know, five will break even, one will make bank and pay for everything else, right? So, and I think Ro has essentially done that for them. So they're going to roll it into more movies as opposed to a Lamborghini for Ami. You know, I think that's kind of
that's
the
what
problem.
I was going to say. Everyone treats it like a business. They're treating it more like a ongoing lifetime business as opposed to Trotters Independent Traders.
As opposed
who are
to
trying
one,
to make a,
yeah, one business.
Some dodgy
yeah.
geezers are trying to get one big payday, one big score, and then they're good to go.
Yeah. Yes, thank exactly. you for the grant. Yeah. See ya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't want to be ya. Yeah. So potential writers, if you are listening, if you are watching right now, take part in the Kuman Screenplay Writing Competition. You can find out more details on the Kuman Pictures social media pages. We'll share the... I think we've retweeted this stuff already, so you can check it out on Goggler MY as well. And take part. It's a good thing. All right, on to some international news. We had some very interesting casting announcements this week. So we'll lead with the first one. So the first movie is Renfield, which is a Universal monster film. And R.M. Renfield is a character from Bram Stoker's Dracula. In the book, he's an inmate at the asylum. He's suffering from delusions, but actually, you know, his suffering and trauma comes from being Dracula's servant.
Only he hasn't been bloodsucked yet. So he wants to be, as Tom Waits classically said, he wants to serve the master.
Correct. So this is a movie that centers around his character, which is going to be played by Nicholas Holt. We've had more casting news from that. Awkwafina is joining the cast as well. And Nicolas Cage as Dracula.
As the man himself, which is...
The man himself. I woke up in the morning, I opened up my phone, I saw this pop up on Instagram, and I let out a little yelp. I was so excited. I was just like,
Who's the director for this one?
This one is going to be directed by Chris McKay, who did The Tomorrow War and the Lego Batman movie.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
wide
range.
Right?
Yeah.
Over there.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it has to be a little, we're expecting it to be a bit comedic, I think. Right?
Quirky, at least.
Quirky, I think. Who knows? I think quirky is a good word. Yeah. I mean...
Unless Awkwafina is doing a really serious turn.
Which I've seen her do, haven't I?
I haven't seen The Farewell. Was The Farewell?
The Farewell is very, very good.
That's a serious movie, right?
It's a very serious movie. It is probably the one time where she isn't Awkwafina. Because even as a dragon, she was Awkwafina.
Right. That's why I'm wondering why you keep chuckling when you're talking about The Farewell. I'm like... Is it the same movie? I didn't hear it was funny.
No, you know, grandma dying. Yeah, exactly. It's all about
that. You're yucking it up at that stuff, right?
Yeah.
Feel good movie of the year. But they've got another one. So, like, this is like a Renfield movie, but then isn't there a Dracula movie that Chloe Zhao is supposed to be directing?
What?
Oh, I don't know this one.
Yeah, I don't know this one.
I thought... It was either Chloe Zhao or someone else who was like an Oscar winner who was doing a Universal Monsters movie. Because they're trying to redo the thing after the success of The Invisible Man, right? And they're trying to do, instead of doing a joint universe with Tom Cruise, they're trying to do these smaller films, which is probably a better idea.
It does sound familiar, but it was supposed to be like relatively unlinked, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm. It's not like they're going to bring everyone together at the end.
Yeah. Was it the Wolfman again?
No. Oh, it might have been. Oh, I can't remember.
So we got the Wolfman, we got the Mummy, we got...
Dracula.
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Dracula.
Is like Universal, is he?
Yep. Creature from the Black Lagoon. Who else was in... Frankenstein.
Is it Creature from the Black Lagoon? Frankenstein, yes. Obviously. Yeah, sorry. Yes. Maybe there's a Frankenstein thing, I think. Oh,
I don't know. I need to look that up. I'm excited. I'm super excited about this. Anything with Nicolas Cage. I still haven't seen Pig, Hog...
Pig.
Yes.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen that yet.
But I mean, it's called Renfield. So I'm getting like, what was that John Cusack movie where he played Igor, right? It was an animated movie.
I don't know that one.
Oh, yes.
I think it was that movie about Igor. It was called, Igor. I don't think it really set the world on fire, but that's that kind of like, well, everyone's done Dracula movies. Let's look at the, to use the Star Wars analogy, the second Ewok from the left. You know, it's like, what's his story?
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of Nicholas Holt now. I mean, I'm just starting on The Great season 2, and Holt's just great. I mean, that show's great. So you know, it's in the title. It's great.
The Great is available on Disney Plus Hotstar, right, Bahe? The first season.
No, it's not. Oh, I looked it up. No, it's not. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
That's annoying.
Which is unfortunate. Yeah.
Seriously, I mean, not enough people are watching that show like here. Obviously, they have no access. But
is that Catherine the Great?
Yes.
Yes.
Who plays Catherine? Is it
Ellie Fanning?
Ellie Fanning.
Okay.
Yeah. And
I think it's on something here. I don't know.
I think it was on Hot Stuff for a while, but I looked it up recently and it's not there anymore unless the search has just broken.
It's the more fun version of the story that we saw on HBO.
I mean, to be fair, the full title is the Occasionally True Story.
Ah.
This week also marks the end of Money Heist. The final season airs on Netflix. And just as that happens, Netflix is getting to ramp things up again with their Korean remake, now featuring Park Hae-soo from Squid Game as Berlin.
If you look at the original tweet, I mean, we did actually get an email about the rest of the cast ages ago.
We didn't recognize any of them from any
of the Korean shows. None of it meant anything.
Now, exactly. Post Squid Game, everything's important. Yeah.
Yeah, although I had a look again. I think there's one or two I might recognize from some shows I watched an episode of two of, but I didn't. None stuck out to me. But I'm in two minds of this. This is, I mean, it's fine. I have no problem with the idea of doing Korean remakes of Spanish shows or Western shows or like that. Like, America's going to ruin Squid Game with a remake at some point anyway. So things going back the other way is fine. I hope they don't, like, they change the iconography a lot, you know, and this plot.
That's what I was hoping as well. And you know what? I think they might, just because they still want to cater to a Korean audience, right? I mean, that's always been their true north with everything they do. All of these shows, yes, it has global appeal, but they first and foremost cater to a Korean audience.
Yeah. But I think like what Ian says is on point, because that picture of that announcement video, the fact that he's holding the Dali mask, which is, yes, it's iconic, it is so attached to Money Heist, but like, I don't know if it works for a Korean market, right? Like if
it's like doing anything with the V for Vendetta mask anymore. It's so passe and it's overdone.
Yeah.
And also I think they might have, there's so much thinking about Money Heist. And when you think back on it, there's so much in there which is about the professor saying, we're going to stick it to the government. And I don't think, I don't know from what I've seen in Korean dramas, they don't have the same ire for their governments.
Yeah. No, because even if you look at Squid Game, at no point do they blame the government for their woes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that they don't necessarily address. That's one thing. But also, just going back to the iconography, I agree with you, Bahe, but also a lot of K-drama is very comfortable with Western iconography. Like, they borrow a lot from Western, like even the sci-fi stuff and all of that. And they're okay making those references, because I think they too grew up watching a lot of American shows.
But maybe if one person's wearing Dali, someone else has got a Picasso mask, somebody else has
They have to change it up. Yeah.
Go mask.
Yeah.
That would be interesting. You can have it free Netflix.
I think it's sort of like what Ian's saying. It's not that I have a problem with the South Korean people walking around a Salvador Dali mask. It's just that the Salvador Dali mask is so attached to the Spanish Money Heist. And I think that's the issue for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But like all adaptations, right? I don't want a shot-for-shot remake.
Yeah.
I've already seen it on Netflix.
Yes, exactly.
So if you're going to release it next year, I want something different. Yes, it's a heist show. It's a robbery show. It's a caper.
Yeah.
But make it contextual to Korea, and that would be great.
Also, it's already shot, apparently.
Yeah, dude, because I think
it's finished.
I think the release was delayed because of the pandemic. Because remember, we got the casting news like a year ago or a year and a half ago. We got those emails.
Underneath the tweet that I got this photo from, when the next tweet down is, because I wanted to see if it was like someone, the first one said, oh, this is fake. And then I was like, oh, is it? The next tweet after that was, yes, here's the cast. And oh, by the way, it wrapped ages ago. So they're done, apparently.
Ooh, exciting.
I'm excited.
The thing I forgot to mention, I had a slide and I forget sometimes to put the slide in, is the Squid Game v Black Milk fashion collection. Have you seen this? Black Milk is an Australian brand, so of clothing brand, and they have a load of like leggings. They do leggings and t-shirts and stuff and dresses and things, and they're selling, I think it's $129 Australian dollars for the tracksuit, and you can get it personalized with your own number on it if you want.
Fuck.
The idea of a capitalist merchandise tracksuit based on Squid Game is in itself just a mockery. But
and some of the other stuff, it's like there's leggings with like all the security guards looking at you, which is just weird. I visual aids. I forgot the visual aids. Damn it! I'm like the science teacher who's always coming in late without the wrong thing.
But they're not stopping there, right? They've also announced a Berlin spin-off. They want to keep this franchise going, and I'm okay with it because they've ended the main story. Because like, I think if they kept the main story going even more after they ended it once in season two, I'd be like, okay, enough.
Yeah.
Well, I know, again, I kind of forget about Money Heist. We talked about it before. We talked about it when the last
part one came out.
Half aired. Yeah, and it is like they had a compelling reason to pull them back together again. That was good. I'm slightly worried about the new Berlin, the Berlin show, because he did. Like, he died ages ago.
And he's all the way through
the last couple of... Yeah, but he's all the way through the most recent season.
But he's so good,
there's so much flashback.
Because he's so good, though. You know? And I think... Yeah, so I'm caught in between the two of you. Like, I love the actor, I love the character, but also you're right, he hasn't actually left the show.
Yeah, whereas we need a full six seasons and a movie, Helsinki Adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know it's coming.
And it's just him, and it's just a flashback to him in Nairobi going around the clubs. That's it.
That's the whole show. Yeah. Every season is a different club.
Yeah. Oh God, that's a long. Oof, that's a hard sell for me.
Redefining Netflix bloat. Yeah, we've got Berlin coming. We've got Korean Money Heist coming. We'll eventually have Squid Game season 2. Let us know what you think about all of these spin-offs and sequels. You know how to get in touch. Goggler MY are our social media pages. Also, podcast at goggler.my. If you feel like sending us an email, you can also WhatsApp us on the hotline. That's 012-524-5208. Okay, let's talk movies. This one is a brand new film by Jane Campion. You will know her, of course, for being the Oscar-winning director of The Piano. She directed Portrait of a Lady. She hasn't actually directed a film since 2009's Bright Star. So this is her first movie in 12 years. It's called The Power of the Dog. It's got a fantastic lineup. Benedict Cumberbatch, Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons, Cody Smith-McPhee. And it's based on a 1967 novel by Thomas Savage, which is actually a big inspiration for Annie Proulx, who wrote Brokeback Mountain. And when you watch the movie, you will understand why.
Sounds about right, yeah.
And the story is centers around Benedict Cumberbatch, who's Phil Burbank, and he's this man's man, a rancher who's like raising cattle on his family's Montana ranch, and he doesn't bathe and he smells and
for choices,
and his life is completely ruled by the teachings of his mentor Bronco Henry, right? But he's also just a horrible shit and just treats everyone around him like crap, especially his poor brother Jesse Plemons.
Well, primarily is, but I mean, we didn't see him treat his brother like crap. He gets on well with the state, with the farmhands.
He does. Yeah. But everything kind of kicks off when they're eating one day at a restaurant, and they meet Rose, played by Kirsten Dunst, and her son Peter, played by Cody Smith-McPhee, and George, Jesse Plemons, is immediately taken by Rose and falls in love. And Phil doesn't like the fact that this woman has taken his brother away from him, and this kind of opens up a journey into secrets, his past, and, you know, kind of undermines this whole idea of what does it mean to be masculine in America.
Okay, can I quickly, are you done? Can I quickly just jump in?
Yes,
because like, okay, cool. I
so can we just, that's our new link. So
are you done? it's because I watched the movie and then I sort of, when, and I go back through Netflix, and then there's the description of the show comes on, and it goes, a domineering but charismatic rancher wages a war. I'm like, charismatic rancher? A stretch, but okay. Wages a war of intimidation on his brother's new wife and her teen son until long hidden secrets come to light. Huh? Was there a secret?
Factually, I mean, it's accurate.
It's accurate. Really?
I mean,
yeah.
It's a war of psychology.
Yeah, war has, but it's not even, it's like, my review of A Castle for Christmas this week. It's like, you expect all these things to happen, and like, a war implies there's going to be like, you know, massive kind of fights and like,
right,
tiny microaggressions, also stuff happens, but it's incredibly spaced out. It's spaced out as wide as the mountainsides of Montana.
I'm not, my argument isn't against the word war. My argument is against the long hidden secrets coming to light. I'm like, was there long hidden secrets?
We don't want to get the spoilers, but like, yeah,
there were.
I mean, I got that there's the cabin in the woods, shall we say?
Yeah,
that element of
right.
Yeah. That's the long hidden secrets. The things that were in the suitcase.
Yeah, but it never really comes. It's not like, my thing is that it's not like it came to light, right? Like, it's not like it gets discovered and a big hoo-ha happens. It's,
yeah, no, this movie is
not big hoo-ha. Yeah,
yeah. I was gonna say, this movie is like an awful lot of nothing happening for long periods of times, but very beautifully lit and subtle. I could say, as a way, like, Jodie Smith McPhee figures stuff out.
Yes.
I think.
Yes.
I think that's why. But there's no like, oh. It's just like, I found something and I'm going to act on that. But there doesn't even give you any indication that he's realized that. It's only within the story happening.
Yeah.
And I think I went into this with high expectations because I'd seen so many people saying like, wow, powerful filming making. And I didn't get that. I had struggled to get through this today. It's a bit hours long, right?
2 hours and 8 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I struggled because it seemed like it just took forever to get anywhere. Like even by the time Rose gets to the farm, it's been like half an hour already, right? More, 45 minutes. And it does go on quite a bit. So, and it isn't like, it's mostly, I didn't do it. I didn't do the meme, but you could, you know, it basically just like plays banjo aggressively is like the majority of the war, right?
I'm the same. I had trouble focusing. Like you said, I mean, I admire the fact that Jane Campion didn't lean into the hoo-ha, right? Because that's what we expect from a movie like this. When the dirty little secret comes out, everyone has a big showdown and shows off their acting prowess. And
that
does not happen. And I have to say, I admired that fact because I think that showed a tremendous amount of restraint. But at the same time, for 2 hours and 8 minutes...
I wish something would happen.
I was waiting for something to happen. And I understand. Yeah, and I understand movies like this. It's Nomadland. It's Brokeback Mountain. But heck, even Brokeback Mountain had more passion in it, right? There was...
Yeah.
I think it just had more stuff happening.
It did.
Yeah. No, but you know what? As well, like this sort of... you're right. It's Nomadland. It's Minari. You know, it's that sort of... It's the... This
but
is
Minari
what happens
was
in
funny.
This...
Maybe I paused too many times, but I thought there was just more stuff happening. There are good things that happen in this movie. We'll get to them later, I think. But it's just they're so far spaced out, and it is like I'm whistling a song that I know annoys you from an upstairs balcony, and it's like, wow, that's not really cinematic or dramatic or entertaining. There are moments in this movie that are incredibly cinematic. There's a point where Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst are on a hill with a car in the background, and it's like amazing, absolutely stunning looking. They make Montana at times look like an alien planet from one of Ridley Scott's more recent alien movies.
Yeah, New Zealand is a great stand-in for Montana.
Oh, is it New Zealand? I didn't know.
It is New Zealand.
That makes because there is this kind of like rocks sticking out of like mossy hillsides or green hillsides. And it does the thing better than David Lynch's 1984 Dune, where it says there's a shape in something. Did you see Did you see the shape in the mountains?
Yes, I did.
Very clearly, right?
But it was only after the kid mentioned it. I was like, oh,
after
I
he pointed out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that moment in itself, it's like, you know, Phil is trying to be a sleazeball, and he's actually going somewhere nasty. It seems pretty obvious he has a nasty plan, and he's talking about he's always looking at those hills and he never tells anyone what's there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like he's been looking for someone to mention this for years, and the kid just mentions it. He just puts it out. It's like, oh, yeah, it's that thing. It's a dog. Yeah. So what? And that moment on Cumberbatch's face is fantastic. Like, there's a lot there. Every time he goes to George and he calls him Fatso and thinks that that's fine, and he wants to banter so badly during that first half hour.
Yeah.
And every time he's like, don't leave me hanging, dog. And he leaves him hanging every time.
And George is just like, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I guess that some of that is down to George maybe knowing about the Bronco Billy thing and maybe having something similar involved with that. It's like, no, I don't want anything to do with that. You know what I mean? Like, there's multiple options there for why George is that way, whether it's his nature, whether it's something that happened to him in the past. We don't get any reason for it, though. So there's individual moments that are like, wow, great. But then they don't string together.
I mean, I don't want to sound like a pleb, which I mostly am. But it's the kind of thing where, like, if I have to come up with my own conclusions for all these little things that you just mentioned, Ian, I kind of wish, like, that just sort of feels to me like a film's kind of failed. Because what is the story that you want to tell me? I'm here to watch a story that you want to tell me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, for me, those were the pockets of air that I was swimming between as I was drowning. Yeah. Like, they were like, oh, this scene's amazing.
Yeah.
And then it's like, nothing's happening. Nothing's happening.
Every time I saw Cumberbatch on screen, I kept thinking, you know what? I've never seen him like this before, and that's impressive.
In dungarees.
Yeah. Not just in attire, but just even in performance, even the stance he takes, right, for having sat on a horse far too long, and the way he walks, and And it's not, he is, I mean, if he wasn't so damn good looking, you would mistake the fact that it was Benedict Cumberbatch. And you would just be like, yes, this is incredible. And Kirsten Dunst as well is just so great because she goes down this alcoholic path and it's not played up. It's so underperformed. Yeah. It's not the ha ha ha. I'm on the self-destructive path. And like, yeah, it's so easy to go down that route and she doesn't. And all of the perform and Cody Smith McPhee's Peter is phenomenal, right? Yeah. I mean, there's this brief exchange. And yet again, you're right, Ian. I got caught up in those moments that were so brilliant when he makes these flowers out of paper. And and Benedict Cumberbatch is like, oh, there must be a fine lady who made these. And he's like, it was me, sir. And then it ends, like that whole sequence kind of ends with Benedict Cumberbatch lighting it on fire and using it to light his cigarette.
Yeah.
And it those kind of, like, it's just this beautifully played out microaggression, right? Against Peter.
Oh, it's a macro.
It's full on aggression.
It's big. It's a classic dick move.
There was no need to set the fucking flower on fire. Just light your cigarette, damn it.
Yeah.
No, but the candle's way over there, you see. You can't reach it.
Yeah. There was a lot of that. But I thought, it's a subtlety thing again where it's like he's going subtle until he snaps. Like, there's this snapping thing. Like, this show is basically what if Daniel Plainview was your roommate, right?
Yeah.
Like, it ends up being that an awful lot of time where it's like there is this element of he wants to be, or, you know, what if Shinji was a cowboy? He wants to be, you know, well-liked and beloved and all this kind of stuff, but he still can't break down these barriers. But there's not enough. I've put up the Kirsten Dunst picture there. There's like this hugely cringe dinner party piano scene. And it's like, there are all these great little moments, but they didn't hang together for me. Yeah. Or if it was 90 minutes, maybe it would have hung together for me a little bit more. It seemed to be it was too much nothing for me to go on.
But also, it feels like this is a movie that was made too late in the sense that it feels like Brokeback Mountain did it better, even though the book came a long after Thomas Savage's, right? And
it's been John Carter'd.
Exactly. It's been John Carter'd. It feels like this movie and its message about America and this invisible side to masculinity that's been buried would have been revolutionary if it had come out 20 years ago.
Yeah.
When no one in Hollywood had made like a mainstream movie like this with an A-lister like Benedict Cumberbatch, right? But Brokeback Mountain went there and did it.
But I think also the issues are that this movie never really does it. It implies it. It sort of winks at it. It sort of alludes to it, but it never really does it. And I think it just feels like, you know, like, I'll be honest, when the movie ended, I was like, okay, I guess.
Is that it?
Yeah, I'm like, whoa, happened? Yeah.
Okay, can I just say, I'm really glad you guys feel the same way because I finished the movie and I was like, am I an idiot? Is everyone else going 95% on Rotten Tomatoes?
I'm aside to write the review and I'm like, I'm the SpongeBob. I was like, the SpongeBob meme. I guess I'm going to head out. I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to write with this. Because I had seen tweets last weekend saying, staggering, amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
revolutionary.
The Brokeback Mountain thing is, like I said by here, it's like, it says it, but it's also slightly reactionary or backwards in that it's like, the Brokeback Mountain element of it is kind of the cause of all his shitty issues, which is like not a great message to be saying in 2021.
But I think also the problem is, it's like if this movie, I think to sort of follow on what Uma was saying, if this movie had come out before Brokeback, it would have been great, right? Like, Benedict Cumberbatch is playing this character who nobody potentially wants to play. But you're right, this many years after Brokeback Mountain, it just feels like, you know, I mean... We've seen that kind of stuff on TV. You know what I mean? Like,
This does feel like, but even with this, with the very few cuts, could have been a 1989 or 1990 movie, I think.
Yeah.
You know, there's all the frolicking in the river bit, but there's not that much frolicking. It's not like, it's not that excessive or forward. I don't know what the word is looking for, but you know what I mean? It's not that explicit.
Oh, no, it's not explicit at all. Yeah.
I mean, this movie can just be summed up by, you know, somebody heal Phil.
Really? I have to say, though, the one thing I did really enjoy, the Johnny Greenwood soundtrack.
Johnny Greenwood also did There Will Be Blood, right?
Yes, and The Phantom Thread.
Yeah, but there was no cowboys in Phantom Thread, so.
I haven't seen Spencer, but apparently he did the soundtrack for that as well. He does haunting really well, and for those of you who don't know, it's Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead fame. Yeah.
There was a few times I turned the subtitles on because I missed one or two words that Benedict was growling. And it just says uneasy piano plays. Yes.
That's
the new magic. It's the new magical twinkling.
Yes,
uneasy piano, yeah. And it is. And the music is. It's very striking.
Very.
And there's even it changes a lot. I think there's probably a thesis to be written about how like when Jody Smith McPhee. I always forget it's Smith. I don't know why I say Kit. Jody Smith McPhee. When he gets a plan in his mind, it's almost the up until that point very sparse music. Is way more like I think there's more of an orchestra. Or there's more instruments involved at that point, right? It's like the propulsive part of the plot has arrived, and therefore the music, because an awful lot of it is very brittle piano or harpsichord style music, and yeah, that's really really good.
Yeah, it's really really good, and I was listening to it after the movie. I was just playing it while I was writing, and I was like, oh, this is nice. It really creates a scene. It feels like the great outdoors.
But it explains why Daniel Plainview was in the forefront of my mind afterwards. It's like...
Probably. I felt like an idiot. I honestly did, because I finished watching the movie and I was like, oh, I don't know why everyone's going on about how great this is. Am I missing something? Yep.
I no longer feel that way because... Just reading the description.
We're all idiots together here.
But for me, it's like having seen the trailer, I was like, yep, this is going to be one of those things that I don't enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, initially when I was sitting down, I was thinking to myself, I wanted to time myself to see how long it'll take me to get through this 2-hour movie. You know, it only took me about 45 minutes more, but it's fine. But it's just like, these kind of movies don't really speak to me. It doesn't work for me.
What do you mean this kind of movie? Being racist? I mean, honestly, generally, what do you mean by this? Is it just the, like, again, my problem with it is the pacing and the lack of things happening. Like I'm all on board with mood, tone, poems, elegiac landscapes. But there has to be more of a kind of.
And for me, this movie has great characters. They're just not using them in a way that I find compelling. Because
Jesse Plemons walking away from his wife after dancing with her because it's the only kindness he's ever been in, you know, had in his life, and tearing up is all time.
Yeah,
like it's amazing that scene.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's got all of these great performances, but also all of these great characters, like Phil on the page. Mm. Is a fantastic character, and to be able to perform that character as such a reprehensible human being, but yet someone you can make the audience sympathize with, is pretty incredible. But you're not using them in a way that I find compelling.
Yeah,
I mean, when I say movies like this, I mean I'm thinking of this. I'm putting this in the same bracket with something like Nomadland and even you know, even to a certain extent. Well, you know, Minari has got a point. But I think Nomadland and this sort of are on... Like, I'm not... I don't hate it, but I don't know what I just watched. I don't know why I'm watching it as well. You know, because, like, I don't know what the end of the story is. I don't know why we're here. And I think that, to me, feels unfortunate. It doesn't work for me. Just those kind of... And I've been in enough art house movie film discussions to talk out with the best of them, but it doesn't work for me. Yeah.
Which means it's going to win Best Picture this year.
It's probably going to win Best Picture. Yeah. I mean, like, what's his Rotten Tomatoes score? You know, it's pretty high.
95, 97%, something crazy. Yeah,
Don't bring them into this conversation.
How dare you, sir? I've seen the tweets from people saying, like, it's the favorite movie of 2021 and the best movie.
And I do think we might have been a little bit more happy with it if we'd watched it in the cinema. Which I think a lot of critics in the US have.
Can I just say, that was the one thing I kept thinking when I was watching it, even on my television. It's not that big. It's like a 50-something incher. I kept thinking, this would look absolutely stunning on the big screen.
But my counterpoint where that when this comes up is that, like, this didn't hold me, so I was putting the wash on.
Yeah.
Doing some other shit. But like,
And if you're forced to sit in a room, it might have a different...
Have a different impact. But the other thing is that, the exact same screen is where I watched Greyhound and I was glued. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's always my counterpoint to those kind of things.
Yeah. All right, Power of the Dog, now on Netflix. You can check it out. Benedict Cumberbatch, Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons, Cody Smith McPhee. Let us know what you think when you see this movie. Are we completely wrong? What are we missing? GogglerMY is where you can reach out on our social media, podcast@goggler.my if you want to send us an email, and 012-524-5208 to WhatsApp us on the Goggler hotline. Heading over to a movie that we really enjoyed. it opens this week in Malaysia, Ghostbusters Afterlife. It's a couple of weeks out of the US.
Settle in.
This one is directed by Jason Reitman, who is the son of Ivan Reitman, who, of course, directed and produced and co-wrote the original film. It stars McKenna Grace. It's got Paul Rudd in it. It essentially is a kind of a reboot of sorts, or a sequel of sorts, actually, not a reboot.
It's a sequel. It's a legacy requel.
Is that what the word is? Like a requel, like The Force Awakens, right? A legacy requel.
I put the requel in my review, but there is something else they call it. I saw someone at the Escapist magazine had a name for it. There's something. It's not a requel because it's a legacy sequel.
Right.
It's this idea of like passing the torch.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. But honoring the original and following it on. But it is, yeah, The Force Awakens.
Which is the first movie that came to mind when I left the cinema, right? And also because The Force Awakens and Ghostbusters Afterlife does something very similar in that they are very reliant on the original set of films, almost derivative to a certain extent, but it's also something that was necessary given, one, the time period and also the response to the previous Ghostbusters reboot that came out. And this one felt like it was something that was made very much for the fans. That said, mm-hmm. I have to say, it was also a very good way to do a female-led reboot of Ghostbusters.
Yeah, yeah.
Because McKenna Grace is the central character. She and her family move to a small farm after her grandfather passes away and bequeaths it to them.
Oklahoma, right?
Oklahoma, yeah. There are strange happenings on this piece of land and this small town, and there are earthquakes, inexplicable earthquakes, and it turns out to be ghosts, people.
You'll never figure out who her grandfather is.
I mean, that wasn't intentionally trying to keep it a secret, right? I mean, it was pretty obvious, even from the very first frame, right?
I think there's hints in one of the trailers, but if you don't know, I think they do keep it within the movie intentionally vague enough that you could be like...
For newcomers, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it does a good job of that. Like, nothing we've seen has shown us what the opening of this movie was.
No.
It's just like, oh, I'm pleasantly surprised. This isn't Finn crashing his TIE fighter on Jakku planet. There's something happens. You're like, oh, this is okay. My curiosity. I'm right involved. This is good. I'm on board. And then we get to the plot. And one thing I really loved about this movie was the pacing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, this is a family finding out their history, and mom does not give a shit
about
any of this stuff.
Well, she's hurt and she's got her own problems, right?
Yeah, and Finn Wolfhard is also there. He's not even he fixes the car and that's about it. But Grace McKenna as well, it's not like she's super, I have to find out what's going on in this house. It's like things happen at a really, really unfold at a really nice pace as these small things happen. And the chessboard thing is really, really nice. Like, they really just that's teased out. It's not made a big deal of. She doesn't make a big deal out of it. And it's just like, I really enjoyed that element of it, in that it was a Ghostbusters movie, but it also totally had its own plot pace and was doing its own thing.
I think what I enjoyed about it was exactly that. They let it do its own thing before getting to the fan wank, which I also enjoyed. But it was given its chance to shine. She was given a chance to shine, and she is fucking great. Every time she told one of those jokes, I was like, yes!
That is the worst jokes in the world.
I think that joke.
I think we were the three guys in the hall that were laughing
the loudest.
If not the only. Yeah, yeah.
But we weren't the ones cheering. Everyone thought we were the ones cheering near the end. There was other people to my right
who were cheering. There were some people in the back who were cheering, right?
We're not those kind of nerds. I mean, come on, please.
But also, the thing which I really liked about this movie is, and it owes a lot. It's interesting because something like Stranger Things, obviously, the series owes a lot to Steven Spielberg and John Carpenter and all of that stuff. And it's funny that, and Ghostbusters as well, and you know, referenced in season two. And it's funny that this show is kind of has some kind of tribute and owes something to Stranger Things.
It's Finn Wolfhard. He's right there.
Well, beyond Finn Wolfhard as well, like in the way it lets the story unfold as an homage, it's a very, it's a very Duffer Brothers approach to things, right? Because this is it's Jason Reitman making a movie and paying tribute to his dad's movie, like in many ways. And I think in an interview he said something along the lines of, I have a movie that's buried within a Ghostbusters film. So, like his movies and his preoccupations with family and this idea of lost identity and dealing with abandonment and all that stuff is buried within that Ghostbusters movie. And I thought that was a very clever way of putting it because, yeah, that's the kind of stuff I enjoy. There are clear parallels to Goonies and Steven Spielberg stuff and all of that. Yeah, it's all there.
Weirdly, Blade Runner as well, I think, because of the name of the font even used on the diner.
Yes.
The Spinners.
Yes, Spinners.
Is a very Blade Runner-y for some reason.
And also the name Spinners.
Know. Yeah, that's it. But that you can buy a t-shirt with Spinners in that font. That's a Blade Runner tie-in t-shirt.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, yeah. So I was like, okay, that's weird. It's a bit odd.
And so I thought, yeah, the pacing and all of that worked because even if you're a newcomer to the franchise and you haven't seen Ghostbusters 1 and 2, I think this is a really fun family show that you can watch with your kids.
But I think the big thing is that what people forget about the first Ghostbusters is that it's not a comedy. You know,
it kind of is though. I've seen people on Twitter saying the other way around.
Oh, really? I agree with Bahe. It's like it has funny moments, but
it's got funny moments, but it's not a comedy. And I think that was the mistake with the female-led reboot was that they wanted a comedic movie. And I think
there was many mistakes with that movie.
Don't forget, mistakes. Yeah.
I mean, I've seen numerous people talk about this, so I'm not sure about how I feel about it myself. But there is this idea that like the Ghostbusters you have in your head is very different from what it actually was. When it came out, it was a Saturday Night Live kind of vehicle for these people, right? It was the Wayne's World of its era, if you think about it. It was originally supposed to be John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd doing this stuff. And I was also supposed to be in the future and just like a couple of cleaning guys
and
messing around.
And that's fine, but that's not the movie that we got. I still feel like Ghostbusters 1.
We still got a movie where Dan Aykroyd gets a blowjob from a ghost.
That's true.
Everyone forgets about that scene.
No, it makes no sense. No, you're right. But my thing still is that it's not a comedy. It's got good, funny moments. It feels like, because it still feels very much like I mean, even the second one where with what's the villain's name?
The Vigo the Carpathian.
Vigo, yeah. I mean,
Lord Vigo.
It's not. Yeah, he's funny, but like Vigo isn't, right? So there's still very. The stories are still very much rooted in light horror, you know. And I think this one
very light, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this one does that in the same way. Like this feels like you're. I mean, you said it just now, Uma. This feels like a Goonies movie. There's, you know, it's very kid-driven. You know, it's these kids going on these things. I love podcasts. And every time podcast says something about a podcast, I felt it in my heart because it's
really hard. The marketing material for this is like, they just didn't give us even any basic stills. Like, even not just the ones they gave us, even on the IMDb page. I can't get a proper just full-blown photo of a podcast.
He's so good.
He's so good.
We are
love him so much.
On a podcast, but... we may be biased, but he's not immediately annoying and it's funny and it's not that dated and he's a really endearing character.
But the writers get it, right? I mean, it's just like Only Murders in the Building. They get what a podcast is. So when they do it, it isn't annoying.
I mean, this Ghostbusters had what I wish Power of the Dog had, a fucking story. You know, there's a reason we're here. We're following characters doing a thing to a point at the end that's been driven at by other things that, you know, the reason they're all there. So it's just, there's a point to all of this and that's what I wanted. And I think
introduction, rising tension, conflict. Yes.
You know, like you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can move the spokes around a little bit, but it's still a fucking wheel, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really love this movie. I think this movie does the one thing that I wish the last one did for me, which was make me want to go out and buy everything with the Ghostbusters logo on it.
Right.
Yeah.
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 I mean, that we wanted that last one to just either be, oh, what we were wondering, what are they going to do? Is it going to be like the Ghostbusters shut down? They're going to restart. They just ignored it completely. And that, and not only that, they got the original Ghostbusters in it as just small random cameos.
Cab drivers. And yeah.
And that's, we're not angry people on the internet screaming into our microphones about how this needs to be, you know, reverential to the original. But this is just a continuation of the story that makes sense in a really great way. This is the, I wrote it in my review that this is the movie that my 10-year-old self, 11-year-old self, would have lost his fucking shit
absolutely
over this movie.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because this is what you wanted with Ghostbusters 2 instead of the weird, creepy McNichol nanny ghost.
Dancing
toasters.
Yeah. I like the dancing toasters, I have to say.
The nanny ghost is fucking weird.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters 2, one of the greatest lines of all time. I think it's time we put the baby, we have to put the baby down. It's like, you're short, you're fat, and you take up too much of your mother's time.
Yeah. But also, the other thing I really liked about this film is that it's the same with Ghostbusters 1 and 2, right? I watched it when I was too young. I was not supposed to watch it because it did have some serious adult themes.
It's and also, they curse like sailors.
They
it's
do.
A, that's an 18th movie. Yeah. It's R-rated, right?
I don't know. I don't think it's R-rated.
And also, Ghost Blowjob.
Ghost Blowjob. I don't think it's R-rated. Yeah. I need to check that out. But this movie,
PG.
It borders on that, having some moments that are quite adult as well. And so for me, if you were a young kid watching this, because I remember watching Ghostbusters as a very young kid, and there were moments that genuinely scared me because I was at that age when I was like, ooh, this is scary. So it's when you're watching it as a kid, you're thrilled, you're scared, you're excited when these guys show up with their fucking proton packs. And like
when they turn, see, this is where it's not a comedy. They turn on the proton packs. It's like, you know, how do you feel? I got an unlicensed proton accelerator in my backpack. It's like, turn me on, Ray. They turn on Egon, and Ray and Ray and fucking Peter, just like, they're in a, if the nuke goes off, it's taking out 30 city blocks. Yeah. Slightly moving over in the isn't going to do anything.
Again,
that's hilarious.
I don't disagree that it is funny as all
but I see where you're coming from, Bahe, in the sense that it felt like the script for the reboot. The Melissa McCarthy one.
Yeah.
It felt like they were going for every line as a punchline.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think that the first one is like, it's Plato's chair of comedy sci-fi. Like, there's this, there's Men in Black, and I would consider Ice Pirates, but no one else agrees with me. There's no, like, comedy science fiction or comedy action. Not action is not a different thing. But this kind of fantasy, science fiction, comedy.
Yeah.
It's impossible to do. No one gets it right these days, right? And no one even tries to do it because that first movie is all those people outside going, Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters. That was all us in 1985, 86.
Yeah.
All the, you know, this man has no dick jokes. The, you know, we came, we saw, we kicked its ass, all that kind of shit. It's so iconic. And it's just these guys screwing around on set by the, you know, looks of things. And when I hearkened back to Dan Aykroyd's original script, it was not what we got. It was completely all over the place, right? And it was all this stuff. I think there's an oral history of the movie when the 2016 one came out about how even the making of the movie was all over the place. And they were constantly, the effects were being done at the last minute as well and
they
everything
had,
else.
They had trouble with the name. They weren't even sure if Bill Murray was going to show up on day one because they just agreed on a handshake and they had no idea if he was going to turn up. Oh, they also had no license to like shoot a bunch of stuff in New York, so they were doing guerrilla filmmaking in the streets.
And it really is the image. It's the definition of lightning in a bottle.
Yes.
So to try and do anything similar at all, is it possible? But this nailed the tone of trying to continue it on. That said, it could do with a few more ghosts. I think I would have liked to have seen. I think you told us after the fact that this had a budget of $75 million, and that made a lot of sense at a certain point. There's just empty cup cars and that's it. And you see an old timer 69er, but that's it. I would have liked to have seen a bit more of the like soundtracking it to some 80s hair metal wouldn't have been great, but like this, they're almost going for the same scenes in certain ways of the original movie. And that is one thing where I felt I could have done a little less of. As the movie got closer to the end, we started hewing more and more towards the lore of the original. And I think, you know, I've talked before about what I thought the MacGuffin should be. I was amazed how closely it hews to the lore of the original. And
right.
very much so. And it's very much a sequel. It's not like... I don't have a problem with it so much, but I would have been interested to see like all these unknown adventures of the Ghostbusters. Like, this is some other artifact they found on their adventures. I think right. that's something they could do and maybe will do later. But when the nostalgia elements kick in, I've seen a lot of people complaining about those online. When they really get in there at the end, I thought that actual pacing that I was enjoying so much got slightly derailed.
I didn't care at all. I was completely into it.
I'm a simple man.
Put this way, just to address your first point, Ian, and I think you're right about hewing closely to the original, but I feel, yet again, just to go back to the Force Awakens comparison, it feels like this is the movie, and I think that's why Sony just wanted to spend $70 million and not break the bank on it, but they felt like, oh, well, this is the movie to bring everyone back. And then, if it's successful, we see where we take the franchise, because the Ghostbusters comics have gone to all kinds of places. Like, that has been the primary medium to, like, expand the lore, right? Because I haven't seen any cartoons in a while. But the lore is fun, right? And so I think this feels like the gateway drug, right? Get people invested in it again. Maybe they might go see Ghostbusters 1, 2 on one of the streaming networks somewhere. And then, like, Sony set up that Ghost Core thing, and you know they have some kind of investment in this franchise. And to be fair, it's a franchise with a lot of potential. And and you could tell a lot of stories. So I was okay with that. And I was okay with the kind of fan service, because I felt it was a satisfying resolution, like something that the last movie was missing. And I think now you can move on. Right? I think I would have been upset if it wasn't there.
Yeah, I'm thinking the way like what's in the dirt, right? That's an actual arc for this movie, and it's paid off and explained, and like you're wondering about it, right?
Yes,
there's a setup
time.
At the beginning, and like the whole time through it, there wasn't that in the 2016 version.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It was just a series of things happening while Kate McKinnon was gurning all over the place delightfully. But the rest of the movie didn't keep up.
Yeah. And for me, that was the fatal flaw with that last one. I didn't have a story that I could get my claws into. And at the very beginning of this one, there was a mystery that was set up.
Yeah.
And it kept me invested. And the mystery was, like, despite having Gozer and all of that stuff, which was in the first movie, the mystery was something separate, right? And that's what made it work. So I also have to say, we talked about this briefly when we stepped out of the cinema. I love that they use what looked like stop motion animation.
Yeah.
So it recreated the look of the original characters or the original bad guys.
The creatures, I think they had some onset puppetry definitely in the Walmart. I'm not sure about the rest of it, whether some of that was, because you can't tell these days they can balance it. But they made it look like some, right?
Yeah.
There is some great, like I put it up there, the Ecto-1 tearing through cornfields. Like there's just there's imagery in this movie that works really well. I suppose it's a little, the lore thing I didn't mind so much with the Stay Puffed, the mini mellow guys.
It was just a bit of cuteness.
That was a bit of cuteness. That was fine. Some of those were like hilarious in their like nastiness to each other or themselves, just like committing suicide in the most confectionery way possible. But there's a lot to like in here. What did you think of Paul? Paul Rudd does not destabilize us in any way. It's just like, it's weird he's in it, in a way. Like, it could have been Carrie Coon. I'm not that familiar. What was the big thing Carrie Coon was in, apart from Avengers? Because that's where when she was in Avengers as one of the four horsemen of Thanos, it's like, everyone mentioned she's in some other TV show where she's gotten very good plaudits, right?
Leftovers,
yeah. So I've not seen that.
Yeah,
so,
same.
She's great in this, and it's like, when you see Rudd in there, it's like, what? You know, it's like, he's going to be running all over the place. And that's not a bad thing. And he's us.
Yeah.
Right?
He is us. But he's not over, right? And I think that's why it works. It's still a very restrained performance.
No, but restraint is one, but it's also, they didn't make it about him, right? It's not
exactly
the story. He doesn't.
Despite
what the poster wants you to think.
He's got the biggest head on every poster.
He's not the focus of the story. And I think that was beautiful, right? It's not the... it's not the next generation Ghostbusters, you know. It's not that idea. But no, I really like Rudden. I hope he sticks around. I hope there's if there's a next one, I hope he comes back, because I really like him as a grounding character.
Man, McKenna Grace is great, right? Like,
she's great.
I'm watching it and I'm thinking to myself, if I was watching this as a kid, I would be like, yes, I want to be like her. I want the costumes. I want to learn how to play chess.
I'm 43 years old. Awesome. She's my role model. Yeah.
I mean, when she pops out of that gunner seat, we've seen it in the trailers. That was exciting. Seeing it in the trailer was exciting, but wait till you fucking see it in the film. It's the best. Yeah. It's great that your main heroes aren't jocks. You know what I mean? Right? It's a guy who's walking around with a boom mic. It's a girl who's socially awkward, you know.
And loves science.
That was just great. I thought that was great.
And it's a summer school guy who's into seismology.
It's a summer part-time teacher who's just rolling out videotapes for the kids and not actually teaching them anything.
Oh, that's a great gag. The repeated tapes is really good.
Yeah. I was like, no, it's so much fun in this.
I mistakenly thought that Rick Moranis was going to be in this, but I was wrong. He's actually agreed to
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah, show up for Honey, I Shrunk the Kids reboot on Disney Plus, I think.
Oh,
gotcha.
Yeah, so I thought I had it in my head for some reason, so I was spent the movie going, where's Moranis? Like in my head, like, is he going to show up? What's going on?
Because, I mean, when we're finished, no one's seen the movie, it's only here today. When you watch the movie, do not leave the cinema until all the credits have rolled.
Two post-credit scenes.
Yeah, the first one is incredibly cute.
Brilliantly placed mid-credit scene.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was great.
Which also goes some way to addressing some of the ickiness from the first movie as well, which I thought was very cleverly played. Yeah.
The second one kind of sets up something for later, but also calls back to something, which is very nicely done. Mm. That was really nice. We should also mention as well the music. One thing, it's a game, you get the Ghostbusters in your head. Every time I watch it, I forget how fucking weird that soundtrack is.
Yeah.
The original movie soundtrack is odd. And it's not just the theremin, so it's like there's so much weirdness going on. The piano music. Yeah. Like, it's odd. And they did such a really good job of recreating that here, that it really brought me back and got me right in that trench where they needed me to be.
And they didn't abuse it, right? They didn't use the music exploitatively. And I think that's what I really liked about it as well. It used themes. It used musical themes from the original in a very good way.
Mm.
Although there is one point where they say it's definitely a class 5. They're definitely ripping off James Horner's Utera Nebula battle from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. It was really, really jarring for me.
You think it's more placement music that they forgot to take out, or they went, hey, actually this really works.
This works, yeah.
It just steals it very much. It's like it's like something's happening, it's like it goes, but it's like I actually just saw the Spotify soundtrack was at the same time and I checked it. It's like, yeah, that's, you're totally doing
this. I mean, and that's so iconic, right? From Wrath of Khan. It's like, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Because they just keep flying past each other over and over again. No, Ghostbusters Afterlife, we highly recommend it. Whether or not you've seen the originals, if you haven't, go watch the originals too. But I think it's one of those rare sequels that stands well enough on its own. And it's a real pity you can't take your kids to the cinemas yet. Because I watched the original Ghostbusters with my mom, and she was the one who introduced it to me, and I was far too young. No, I'm telling you, I was far too young, and I didn't know what all the words meant. So, like, I was running around going, let's show this prehistoric bitch how we do things downtown. And my mom's like, you can't say that in school.
I think I was ushered out of my parents are obviously a bit more together. Yours, I was ushered out of the room when the chair attacked Dana. I was like, what's happening there?
Before we sort of wrap up, I just want to say, if anybody out there wants to pull together an order for the proton packs, let us know. Reach out. I think there's probably two.
We might be
here.
Able to save some money on shipping.
Well, where are you trying? Which ones are you going? Are you ordering them off Adam Savage?
I'm just saying, if somebody's got an in somewhere, if somebody knows a phone number that and they want to order, let us know. We'll probably order a couple ourselves. So, keep that.
But I mean, is there a specific toy version you're talking about?
There's an accelerator.
Oh, is there?
Hasbro
okay.
But I haven't seen a pack. Is there a pack?
I think there's a two-in-one. I think they're selling it separately, which is the problem.
God damn it.
Yeah. Okay. So if anybody knows, I want it.
That's something else I liked a lot was that the PKE meter was decidedly old school tech looking. had those nice lights and everything on it.
So if anybody's got any hookups or ordering anything for anything from the Ghostbusters props, let us know. We'll probably,
you know, here, you can just head over to the RPF here, but here they have specs to
build
your own.
I tried the RPF thing. It's too scary.
I got it
in my head once. I thought I wanted to build my own lightsaber, and I'm like, no, this is I
can't. It's not small. Maybe make a PK, maybe make a trap.
I'm not man enough for this. I can't do it.
Also, the amount of money we will end up spending also buying that. Tools.
Yes, just to
and,
do the thing
and yeah. a special shed in order to build it.
Yeah, but all of that is an investment for the future when you build your fully posable Hulk outfit or whatever, you know, or you're like giant space Warhammer 40k space marine fucking armor or whatever the hell you want. You know, these all things pay off.
Step at a time.
Ghostbusters Afterlife, we cannot recommend it highly enough. Go check it out in cinemas. You know how to reach out to us. Once you do, we want to talk to you about it. GogglerMY, our social media feeds, podcast@goggler.my. If you want to send us an email, and 012-524-5208 is the Goggler hotline. You can send us a WhatsApp there anytime, day or night. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Goggler Podcast.